Hi, Martin Purnell here again. Occasionally, I have a guest and there is so much to share that it becomes clearly evident that it has to be a two-parter. You might have already heard part one. Here's part two with today's special guest, and that is Kevin DeVries. Let's take it down to two people then in this fictional brewery that you and I are in. Okay, I'm pulling the pints or whatever. Two people walk into the room. One of them is just crying out in despair. Because I think people listening today most probably will know someone that's unfortunately taken their own life. And that person could be that person wanting to do just the same. You've got the second person who thinks, actually, I've been through your courses, I feel a lot better, or I'm in a church and I feel a lot better. We've got two different people. What would you first of all say to the person who is just really clinging on to whatever strands of life he or she has got left? What would you say to that person?
Yeah. Stay in your story, but don't get stuck in it. Stay in the story. So it'll get better, but you have to let God write the more chapters. So people that are, and I've been there, I tried to take my life and it didn't work, obviously. So I know what that feels like. It feels like you're in, for Americans, it feels like you're in the Twin Towers and you've got all this jet fuel that's burning behind you because the planes have hit the Twin Towers on 9/11. And you see these horrible images of these people jumping out to their death. And you're like, well, what's that all about? It's like, well, there's two options. In their world, it's either, okay, my skin is going to get burnt off and melt off my skeletal framework. And that's going to be excruciating. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a couple minutes. Or I can jump and it'll be all over in 5 seconds. That's what suicide is. The pain is so high and is so intense that you're like, you're not thinking straight. You're having dark thoughts. And you're just like, I just want the freaking pain to stop. And that's what you do. You jump out the window and you end it. Instead of having to endure a longer prolapse, you know, prolonged period of pain. So I would just say, stay in the story. You are not the author of your story. There's someone bigger that's writing something here. And you won't know the good chapters that are coming unless you stay in the story. But if you end it now, that's not a good closing chapter. You are putting those who love you through basically a lifetime of hell. You're signing them off to a lifetime of therapy. Don't do that. It is selfish. I understand why people are not thinking straight. You're not thinking the people that jumped out of the 9/11, you know, Twin Tower windows were, well, they're not being selfish in a way that you and I would maybe comprehend. I understand how people can walk away saying, man, that was just the most selfish thing that they've ever done. And that's true. But what is also true is that they were in so much pain in the moment, they were not thinking about that. They were not thinking about what they're leaving their legacy behind or the people that they're harming. So I would tell people that are maybe in a better position that are not like, okay, I want this to end. They're like, yeah, I got a pretty good story. I'm doing pretty good. You know, things are pretty good. I would say that, are you helping people? Going back to the other question, if they're not, then maybe you're not as well as you think you are. And then we tell our guys, and it's actually in our workbook, Reframing Your Story, that there's 5 ways to heal. And they're all alliterative, so they begin with the letter C. For Christians, they usually park their truck, if you will, at church. How's it going? Oh, I'm going to church. And then preachers, and I used to be one of them, pastors were like, okay, how's so-and-so doing? Well, I haven't seen him in church in a while. Okay, that may be some indication that they're not doing well, but if that's your only indicator, that's really a bad observation. That's a poor observation because maybe church sucks, right? You ever thought about that? Maybe your sermons are so freaking boring. Maybe the people are so, you know, maybe there's some other things going on here rather than, well, they must not be doing well. They're not coming to church. And have you ever thought about that? Maybe you're not doing church the way it was originally intended. So that's a two-way conversation, but church is a good place to start because what happens at church is you have communion, usually the sacraments, you have songs, worship, you have sermons, you have discipleship, you have studies, you have social groups. So there's nothing wrong with going to church, but if that's all you're doing, then you're actually in a theological thorn bush because you don't, theologically speaking, you don't really go to church because you are the church, right? So in Western Christianity and civilization, we've now, I would say, pornified. We've objectified church. I'm going to church. Church was great this morning and worship was great. And it's like, well, what about God in the mix of this? Like, you're just objectifying everything. Well, I go to that church because the worship is really great. Well, we're all worshiping the same God. What does that mean? Well, I go to that church because the preaching is really good. Well, what does that mean? Are you still a baby? You still have, you need someone to feed you every Sunday morning? You have the same Bible. Like, Are you relying on another human to give you all your information? Are you that lazy? Are you that immature? Like, this is craziness. So church is a great place to start. But if you just park your truck there, you will live a life of anonymity, because most churches are too large for you to really get to know people. Unless it's a home church, that's a whole other thing. So we start with that. And then we're like, okay, that's great. Start with church. Fantastic. Serve there. Become part of the deacon or an elder or whatever you can qualify for, or whatever people think that you're good at and your spiritual gifts, blah, blah, blah. Secondly, we tell them you need to have a place in your life where there's contemplation, where there's no crowd. There's no community. It's just you and your maker. It's like Job at the end of all of his litany of troubles. It's just him and God. His friends are not in the background anymore telling him he didn't do enough devotions and he didn't read the right books and his world is bad because he's bad. God just basically had an encounter with him. And you need to have that space. You can call it meditation. You can call it prayer, mindfulness, whatever word you want to approach on that. You need to have a space where you are connecting with the large story, where you're silent. And you're just listening to what God has to say. I don't pray a lot anymore because I know God already knows my thoughts. I'm more interested in what he has to say. And if I'm going to hear what he has to say, I have to shut my mouth, shut my mind, close, calm my mind, get into a place where I'm contemplating, I'm thinking deeply, I'm not reacting, I'm responding, I'm reframing, I'm asking God to help me see things the way that he sees, I'm asking for empathy. It's very easy to have an opinion. It's very easy to judge because it's all about your ego. You're now in the judgment seat. Mm-hmm. But empathy is basically another step of higher maturity where you're like, okay, I don't understand anything that's going on here, but help me understand what they're going through. Help me put me in their shoes for a moment. What does it look like from their perspective? You can only do that through empathy. And typically that's only initiated because you've suffered as well. And you have that capacity, that bandwidth to do that. So church, contemplation, community is huge, and oftentimes you won't necessarily find that at church. You'll need to find that in a small group or in a recovery group or whatever. It's where people actually know your stuff, where you are known, not where you're knowing things. That's what church does. They give you a lot of knowledge, but where people know you and you are known. And whatever that looks like, whether it's base camp or a small group or a hunting trip or a coffee date or whatever, it's just people need to know enough about you to care. So you're letting people in. You're doing life with people. It's the book of Acts. It's what we figured out when we took 12 men to Israel back in 2017 and began to realize, I think we have discipleship kind of misplaced. I think we think it's a classroom and that's part of it, but it certainly is not all of it. Maybe not even most of it. Most of what discipleship is doing life with people. You're sharing, you're praying, you're walking together, you're doing life together. Your kids are meeting their kids. You're hanging out with their families. You're talking about your troubles, you're living life, you're praying together, you're fellowshipping together, you're studying together, you're doing life together. And that's what community is about. And community, change happens in community. If there's one thing that people will get from the documentary is that we either die alone or we change together. So climbing together keeps people alive. When you're alone, you're at your most dangerous place. So community is huge, and we do that really well with our particular ministry. Probably better than anything else that we do. We give guys a place to belong. And then fourthly is this idea of counseling. And it's where you are letting a soul surgeon come into your life who has a particular set of skills that can deal with a particular set of problems. Trauma is a very delicate thing. It's neurological, it's psychological, it's emotional, spiritual, mental, it's all those things. And at best, we can be first responders to each other, put a tourniquet on, triage, figure out, okay, what kind of level of care does this person need? That's all I do. I'm a first responder. I just get people to the right people. And then therapy comes in where, okay, this person over time is going to get the shrapnel out of your soul. And that takes time, a lot of time. And it needs to be Christ-centered. And it needs to ask the really tough questions and to go back through the past, because our future always runs to the past. So you've got to go backwards before you can go forwards. And that's difficult and it's painful. But under the right surgeon's hand, and that's one of the things that we try to tell men too, and women, is that, you know, a lot of the ways that we misinterpret our story is we think that pain is punitive, that God's punishing us. And in reality, it's probably more closer to an operating room. And the pain that you feel is not punitive, it's actually redemptive. God is a surgeon, his heart is good, his hand is steady, and he's going back into that wound, and it hurts like hell and heaven. And it's meant to, because if you don't feel, you can't heal. And so he puts you on this operating table, and he goes right after the wound, and it's very careful and it's very delicate and it's very strategic, but he knows exactly what he's doing. And so that pain that you're feeling is actually healing you. It's not punishment. You're not in a prison. You're a patient. You're not a criminal. You're a climber. And if you climb high, you have to camp low. So before you go up higher, you got to camp low, get well, because nothing heals in thin air. These are all part of my keynote talks and part of the documentary. So it's that reframing aspect. And then the final one is more of that space of content where you're actually reading the right material. You're filling your brain up with good stuff, whether it's a podcast like this or some type of executive summary of a book, or you're reading a book all the way through start to finish. You're part of a study. There has to be some level of content coming into your life. And unfortunately, I think that because we live in a very cerebral world right now, everybody either parks, if they're a Christian, they park their truck in the church parking lot. Or if they're in the marketplace or just in the world at large, they park their truck in the content space. And they're like, if I just get more information, if I just learn more stuff, it'll all be better. And they abandon everything else. They don't contemplate. They're not in community. They don't seek any counseling or any therapy. So I tell guys that these are like five streams. They're all centered on Christ. There's like an anomaly that happens in the book of Genesis where instead of tributaries coming out of a main river, these tributaries are actually flowing into a river, and that river is Christ. And it's emblematic of that in the book of Genesis, where it talks about the Tigris and Euphrates, and it flows in. And I think what God was giving us was a metaphoric image of this is how you heal. Christ is the river, and all these streams flow into him and flow out of him. It's all concurrent together. And to the extent that you're involved in those five areas, those five C's, is to the extent that you will be healed. And so when I meet someone that is not well, usually it's because they've just parked their truck in one spot and nobody knows who they are, or they're just like information junkies and there's no transformation happening. They're just, all they want to talk about is information. There's nothing transforming in them. But if you can do all five of those things, good things are going to happen. Really good things are going to happen.
And of course, the thing is, if you go to hospital, you're actually allowing the surgeon to operate on you.
Yeah.
And what's encouraged me from what you've shared so far, this is to also emphasize two episodes in Off-Grid Christianity, both with an ex-vicar, now leading psychotherapist in the UK called Peter Mockford. Episode 1 is with Peter Mockford, and I think it's episode 50, Prayer, Mental Health. And he was always saying, stay in it as long as you can, so you can then find out what's going to come to the surface, so you know what's going on. And I think that's what you're saying as well. Don't give up. Don't give up.
Yeah.
Find out what it is. And I love the reference you made about the home as well. Yeah, and the parking lot and everything else. What would you say in closing to all that I've just shared?
Yeah, I just think the great wisdom teachers, they all kind of say the same thing. Nothing goes away until it teaches you what you need to know, right? And so these things persist and they stay there, almost like a piece of shrapnel. It just festers like glass in your brain or sand in your foot, or it just persists. And then you have to take a step back and just say, what is the lesson here? Because that's another metaphor that can overlay, is not only is God a good surgeon, but he's a good teacher. And when the teacher gives the final exam, he doesn't say anything, or she doesn't say anything. The room is silent. And I think sometimes we misinterpret even what silence is. But all these things are meant to teach us, are meant to make us better, are meant to give us our best life. But our best life is really not even a whole lot about us. Anybody that's ever lived a great life, they touched a lot of people. And people, again, they don't remember maybe what you said. They just remember how you made them feel, right? And that you cared and that you empathized. So I would just tell people, learn the craft of reframing your story. And we have two dual platforms. So all the stuff that we've been talking about with Basecamp and nonprofit and faith-based aspects, that's all found at Grace Explorations. That's plural with an S.com. That's our nonprofit site. And then our for-profit site, or the LLC, which is about reframing your story and the new format, the new platform, that's at truesummit.llc. And that material can be used by anybody. I wrote it in such a way that a group of soldiers could use it, a group of students could use it, a group of employees, anybody. It's timeless patterns, universal meanings that anybody can apply. And it doesn't matter what your faith background is, it's true and it works. And if you apply it to your life, you will be able to reframe your story and get to that place where you're like, you know what? Life is pretty good. Why is it pretty good? Because I'm helping people. And that's the beauty of it. We want to get people to a place where they can't help but help people.
Kevin, I never did get a chance to ask you about the Himalayas, talking to the Sherpas, all that sort of stuff. But as I said earlier on as well, it's all there in the film, the documentary.
Yeah.
And if they want to see the documentary, because it is free,
yeah,
how can they watch it, please?
It's on YouTube. They can go to truesummit.llc. It's there. They can go to Grace Explorations, plural with an S.com. It's there. Just Google the True Summit and pick whatever platform. But they're, yeah, it's free. And they've had hundreds of thousands of views. Yeah. It's won a ton of awards. But it is a great story. And kudos to our director. I mean, yes, I was the story in the film, but our director, he did a fabulous job putting all the elements together.
It's stunning. And the picture quality as well, and the drone footage, everything else like that. It's like, oh, I could go there myself. Although I don't really want to, between you and me. I have no intention of climbing a mountain, but it did look spectacular. It looked absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Two questions. One slightly silly, but actually there's real meaning behind it because it's part of my life. I did mention earlier on about Mount Ararat. Very quickly, when you were climbing it, what, if anything, did you hear of the stories about the so-called Ark, and did you see anything?
My quick answer to did you find it is we know where it's not. It's like Thomas Edison. He's one of the great inventors in America. Him and Henry Ford, who, again, created the automobile, or at least mass-produced it, they were very good friends because they, you know, iron sharpens iron, so they were good for each other. But it took him 1,000 tries to find the light bulb, to make the light bulb work. And I think a lot of what we learned, a lot of what I learned, I can't speak for all the other men on it. I mean, I was there for 5 summers, for as long as a month, month and a half sometimes. Sometimes as short as 2 weeks, but never shorter than 2 weeks and never really longer than a month or a month and a half. And it was just a process of elimination. We took a very scientific approach to it. There was a lot of scientific eyewitness accounts. And what I mean by that is that we had satellite keyhole technology that was able to tell us that, yeah, there was an anomaly underneath the ice cap on the eastern plateau of Mount Ararat at about 16,800 feet. That was an anomaly. It was not natural to its surroundings, but it's under the ice. So what do we do with that? And then we also had ground penetrating radar that was confirming that, yes, indeed, there is something underneath the ice that is abnormal. That's an anomaly. And then we had core samples that were interesting. So we did it all. We did ground penetrating radar. We did electrical and seismic resistivity tests. We had satellite imagery. So we approached it very scientifically. We dug Herculean excavation holes down to 40 feet, 8x8, which is incredibly difficult because you're dealing with about half the level of oxygen that you have, that you and I are breathing right now at sea level, mm-hmm. running chainsaws. I mean, and Mount Ararat itself is a very dangerous mountain because it's a standalone mountain along with Lesser Ararat, which is right next to it, but it makes its own weather. So lenticular clouds will form at 15,000 feet and everything could be fine below that. But because it's a freestanding mountain and it's giving off different temperatures, it's creating its own weather system. And so electrical storms are very prevalent there, more so than any other place I've climbed in the world. The mountain itself is a character in the film. If they're interested in that, they can look up Finding Noah. Mm-hmm. The only person famous in it is our narrator, Gary Sinise. Gary Sinise was Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, amongst many other movies that he was mm-hmm. in. Great guy, man of faith, and so he narrates part of the film, but the rest of us are just geoengineers, archaeologists, geologists, and glacier, I mean, all experts in their field. That's a 90 minutes long. Again, you can see it on all the same platforms we gave before. It's on Amazon Prime and YouTube, but it's a great story, and it's a meta-narrative. It's a big story. Every faith, every major world religion has some flood yes. myth or flood story. And now there's like 500 flood legends that came out of that long before there was global satellite communication. So something obviously happened. There has to be one core story. And there was one that just came out that actually took it another step. And Dr. Randall Price, who was our lead archaeologist, is also involved in this latest project. I think it's called The Ark in the Darkness, but it's a fascinating treatise on the theory of the flood as historical fact and how the geological evidence is there if we have the eyes to see it. And it just came out like in the last 6 months. It's part of the Answers in Genesis movement, which is where the Ark is. That's my other joke, is that the Ark is actually American. It's in Kentucky. We were looking in the wrong area. Jesus Christ was an American. All the stuff that you read about in the Bible happened in America, America. So the Ark is in America. It's in Kentucky. We didn't know where to look. So
Well, Jesus has an English accent, so, you know, he could be half right.
Yeah, I'm getting my southern accent. We're going to find the glory of God in Kentucky. It was an incredible journey. What I learned is that my story was not, it wasn't so much about the arc of history. It was about the arc of my story, ARC. That's when I first was diagnosed with PTSD in a way that I could assimilate. We had some special ops soldiers that were with us in 2013 as we were filming Finding Noah, which came out in 2015 in theaters nationwide. And they were the first to tell me, look, dude, you got what we have. And I thought, arc fever? And they're like, no, you have PTSD. And I was like, well, why would you say that? And they said, well, when we look into your eyes, you have that 2,000-yard vacuous stare, lights are on, nobody's home. And then when you speak, you're either, again, punishing your past or you're fearing your future, but you're never now. Your present is being poisoned. And that gave me breadcrumbs that helped me understand, okay, maybe that had a lot to do with the two divorces, the bankruptcy. Right from that point, I didn't know it at that time, but I left Mount Ararat from living in a tent to living in my vehicle for the next 5 years. And it took a while to unpack what that actually was and what trauma does.
Yeah, yeah.
It freeze frames things. So, you know, C.S. Lewis was an Irishman and he wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, also was a World War I vet, was for all intents and purposes an orphan, like his colleague J.R.R. Tolkien. Although one was Anglican, Tolkien was a devout Roman Catholic. They both wrote these fantastical mythologies that I believe in many ways was a catharsis for their trauma.
Mm.
C.S. Lewis was in a battalion, an artillery unit, and he was wounded with shrapnel. The guy next to him turned into a red mist. He was a body at one point, and then he just, you know, was gone. And so he gets sent back to England to convalesce, to heal, and begins writing a story that actually began when he was 16. He saw this faun, the Greek mythological figure, underneath a lamppost in the middle of winter with a Christmas gift tucked under him and holding an umbrella. Happened when he was 16. Just a quick image, kind of like Tolkien with In the Hole on the Ground Lived a Hobbit, you know, these origins that start. And then going through World War I, he's living on the front, experiences it, survives it. Same with Tolkien. His regiment was 950 some odd soldiers. And after the Battle of Somme, there might have been like 16 or 17 of them left. And he was saved through, I believe it was either trench foot or typhoid fever or something. Mm-hmm. But he was sent back. And so he's writing the Silmarillion. And so they're both, I think, it's a cathartic process. They're trying to get rid of their trauma. So I think, and I don't even know if he realizes this, but for me, when I put the goggles on, when he's talking about the witch in the land of Narnia, and I'm speaking of C.S. Lewis, I believe that the witch is representative of trauma and everything she touches is freeze framed and is frozen in motion, which is exactly what trauma does. You never forget the day. You never forget the smell, the name, the sounds. It's stuck. And then the rest of the story continues on. Other people do their life, but a part of you is freeze framed until what? Until you hear the roar of the king. It's always winter, never spring, until you hear the roar of the king. And the roar of the king in that book is Aslan, who is emblematic and is a metaphor for Christ. And so when he comes into the land of Narnia, spring happens. And the same thing with Tolkien. All the dwarves are being pushed out of their homeland because of the dragons. The dragons came, the bells were ringing in the dale, the men's faces were pale. You have this sense of foreboding, and the dragon comes, and the day is never the same because they're pushed out of their kingdom, and they wander through Middle Earth until they bump into Bilbo Baggins, and Bilbo's like, you know what? I have a home and I have my six meals a day, and I could be very happy just being a grocer, as you call me, instead of a burglar, and I would be happy to just be living in the Shire, but I'm going to help you because you don't have a home. I'm going to help you find home. And so you come back to, and Tolkien calls it the Lonely Mountain, and the Arkenstone is at the core of that mountain, but you can't get your gold back. You can't get the harps off the wall like the Jews did in exile. They wanted to take the harps off the poplar trees by the river. You can't get to that place because the dragon's there, because your fear is there. And so they have to conquer the dragon, kill the dragon, get their gold back, get their hearts back, get their life back. But to do that, they have to face fear and run into it instead of run away from it. And so I believe both of them were channeling what trauma looks like. Tolkien especially, because a lot of the things that he saw mechanized, mustard gas, chemical warfare, airplanes with bombs, flamethrowers, machine guns, tanks. I mean, literally in the space of 4 to 5 years, warfare as we know it was radically revolutionized. And so he's seeing this. And so the flames becomes the breath of the dragon. The tanks, you know, become the Oliphants of the Far East and the Nazgul, if you will. I know I'm getting into nerdom here, but they become like the planes, right? They're just screeching and they're bombing and they're strafing. And so he's living in this constant state of misery where in the Battle of Somme alone, I mean, you would know this because you're part of the UK. I mean, a million British soldiers were killed or wounded over the course of several months. But in the first day, 25,000 British infantrymen were gone.
Battle of Somme, 1916.
Yeah, yeah. One day. So he's living through that, and he's an orphan. And so his characters are orphan, just like C.S. Lewis' characters are orphan. And they're basically giving us a poetic landscape of what it looks like to exit at a trauma. You have to hear the roar of the king. When you hear the words of Christ, you're just like Lazarus. You're on the other side of the stone, but his words, his spoken word is more powerful than physical elements. He can speak through that stone, and he's saying to a lot of people probably on this podcast, it's time to rise up. It's time to come back from the dead. The story's not over.
No, he's not.
Your tomb is actually a womb. It's not the end, it's the beginning.
I think if I'm right, Battle of Somme, there were some battalions that actually broke through,
yep.
Especially at the very end of the trench, because it went all the way really from the north coast,
giant arc, yeah.
Going towards Switzerland area, when they broke through, they just came back again. They didn't know what to do.
Yeah, well, there was nobody there to support them. There were so few that got through. The Germans knew in advance what was going to happen. And, you know, British infantry was the exact opposite of guerrilla warfare. I mean, the second lieutenant would blow his whistle and take out his pistol and lead the charge. So you knew exactly what you were walking into. And they thought that all the bombardments had taken out the German positions and they were all hunkered down and they knew they'd already broke the code. They had de-encrypted it. So they knew exactly when the attack was going to start. And so they were ready. And the German machine gunners were like, they literally couldn't keep their guns cool enough. And some of them even stopped firing because they felt like it was murder. It wasn't even warfare, it was just murder. These guys were literally, they weren't running. They were walking into the face of fire. And it was, you know, just seeing that warfare on a scale unknown to humankind, it damages your psyche. And you're already damaged going into it because you already have a displacement of what home looks like. So everything about their literature was not just about a cathartic process to release trauma, but it was about finding home.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's the largest craving of humanity is homecoming. What does that look like?
To summarize everything, and I want to thank you so much, Kevin, because we started at the front end talking about pubs and breweries. At the back end, talk about C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. And where did they go and meet every Tuesday and Thursday? Oh, yes, in a pub.
Yeah.
The Eagle and Child in Oxford. So
For a pint.
Yeah. And discuss things. So it was good enough for them. And surely it must be good enough for us these days. Just a thought. But what a place to go and talk where boundaries have been broken down. Let's get it out there. Let's start talking. But more important, let's listen.
Yeah. Lewis talked about those times when the Inklings met together. He called them the Golden Sessions. And he said the beauty of it was that we entered into a space of time outside time, where they were beyond themselves. It was beyond even brotherhood. It was like the ideas and the stories and the fellowship and the intimacy that those men had together. Yeah, he called it the Golden Sessions, and he intimated that it was like time outside time, that they were, yeah, the chronological clock was working, but it was something more of Kairos time, more God time, or even mythos. That's probably more an accurate description, where it was story time. So when we created Basecamp, we wanted it to have that same feel, like, okay, don't turn this into a PowerPoint presentation because everybody gets that at work and it puts your brain to sleep. Just pretend like you're around a campfire. You've got your feet towards the fire. You have your favorite drink at your elbow. You may be having a smoke and you're just there and just let the story flow out. Just as if you were around a campfire and you're all facing the fire together. There's limited technology. You're not being judged by your performance. There's no shtick going on. There's no hype. It's just you cracking open your chest. And in the darkness of night, the stories then become like embers of the fire. Yes. And they float upward and they become part of the constellation of other stories until it's hard to make out the stars from the sparks. They're all become the same. And that's what we wanted to create, that sense of etherealness, of this elemental sense of, okay, something is happening here. You can't put your finger on it, but man, it's really good. To the point where I want that again. I want to be in that space. And I think that that's probably a good accurate representation of heaven. I think it's the never-ending telling of stories. God telling a story, we're telling our stories, And then we begin to realize that the whole time we were telling our story, God was actually telling his through our story. I think that's a real beautiful thing.
I'll let you speak at the end, if that's all right, just to give the references to the websites so that people can go onto them, because you've got so much to share, you've got so much to give, and I'm hoping that every single person that's listened today has been really energized and realized that, especially if they're really going through it and they're thinking that their life is ending, no, it's not. There is a way out. You can do it. You can do it. If Kevin can, if I can, yep, anyone can. Go for it. Kevin DeVries, thank you so much. Here's your final question then. Fingers on the buzzers for the final time. Who is, sir, your Christian hero?
Well, I mean, Christ is the ultimate, right? Because he's the ideal man. There will never be another like him. I love how he balances humanity and divinity together. It's a fascinating, and it's hard to figure out when he knew who he really was. Maybe that's why he had to be baptized by John the Baptist. Maybe that's why the heavens needed to open and where God needed to say, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." Maybe his humanity needed God to say that to him. And so that to me is a hero of a man who knows who he is, but is also human enough that he's like, "I need to be reminded of who I am."
Who would be your Christian hero outside of the Bible?
Well, we've already mentioned two of them. I mean, I would love, in addition to speaking to the Apostle Paul, I would love to have an inkling moment with Lewis and Tolkien.
Yeah.
Tolkien especially. Gosh, he created a universe. It's just amazing how he took all of his pain and out of that came something profound, something incredibly beautiful. And it was never on the nose. You know, he left it to you to apply it how you would. So yeah, it was allegorical, but not to the extent that maybe Narnia was. That was more obvious. His was very oblique. And part of that's his Catholic upbringing. They're not as obvious or on the point or on the nose as maybe an Anglican or a Protestant would be. And so I appreciate that about him. He just left, it's all there. The theology is all there, the framework, and just brilliant. And then maybe talk about what we just talked about. What was your pen? Was it pain? Like, what was giving you the ink to imagine these things? And just unpack that. That would be just fascinating.
Absolutely stunning. Well, I hope in years to come we can actually physically meet up and do another podcast. But in the meantime, Kevin DeVries, thank you so much. And in closing, for those that want to know a bit more about you and go on to websites, the website addresses are again, please.
For the nonprofit faith base, it's Grace Explorations. That's plural with an S, exactly how it sounds, graceexplorations.com. And then for the Reframe Your Story workbook, and what I'm currently doing with non-faith-based groups or faith-based groups is truesummit.llc. Or they can just Google Kevin DeVries and all that stuff will pop up.
Thank you so much for your sharing and your humility. It's been amazing. Thank you so much today for joining us.
Thank you. I needed this. This was great. Thank you, Martin.
Cheers. God bless. Next time on Off-Grid Christianity. Dave, what do you think the answer is?
Well, first of all, I just want to clarify. Have you got any trousers on, Noel? Because
I'm sorry. No, I haven't. Sorry. I've realized I've been crossing my legs and I shouldn't have done.
Yes, you have got. Yeah, I'm just checking. You're obviously in Spain and this time of year. Yeah, I mean, it's still warm, isn't it, over there?
It's still warm. Yeah. Yes, it's still in English money, 70 degrees plus.
Here we are.
I'm sitting in my shorts. Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So you've exposed my knees.
Always difficult when you're playing guitar when you've got shorts on. We're standing up, but you're okay because you're sitting down.
So please join me for the 100th edition of Off-Grid Christianity with Dave Bilbra and Noel Richards being our very special guests. And it really is a podcast and then some. Until then, cheerio.